pas.
Thanks a lot. Welcome to the Sunday night. There is a solution. Newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please help me welcome our speaker, Melissa C., a compulsive overeater from New York and a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After this share, there'll be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, pleasure to be here. My name is Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I live in New York, and I will, in February, I know that's a bit of a way off. It'll be 10 years of entire abstinence, of back-to-back abstinence. So, and I fully intend, you know, one day at a time to, you know, reach that mark and then some. So, you know, I'm pretty certain that, I've always been a compulsive overeater. There was something inside me from a very young age that I felt different. I just felt, like I was always longing for more, whatever it was, but especially food. I always experienced life as though I wasn't getting enough. And, you know, I had a conversation with my husband when, I don't know, we were just kind of talking about this disease because he doesn't have it and he doesn't get it. And he really likes to eat. He loves food. He loves food. He talks about he talks about dinner at breakfast, but he doesn't have what I have. And I said something once that, you know, all my early memories are food related. And I think that's probably what makes me different from you. And then, you know, he sort of explained to me, he said, no, I have a lot of food memories. In fact, you know, I remember my mother making this and we would have this. And when he would tell it, he would have a different expression on his face than me because his memories were happy. And every one of my food memories from a very early age was a longing for more, that it just wasn't enough. I would say what makes me, and I think it's important for a newcomer to understand that this is not, you know, when you ask people like, are you a compulsive overeater? You know, raise your hand if you're a compulsive overeater. You know, oftentimes people, and I don't know if anyone is here or isn't here, but I would have interpreted as who's fat and wants to be thinner, or who's, you know, who's dieting right now and struggling with their diet. And that's not what this is. You know, what it is for me is that I have like a spot that food just can't hit. You know, when people say like, oh, that hit the spot. I don't have that spot. It never hits the spot. And yet I have this strange obsession that someday, whatever it is I'm eating is going to give me satisfaction. And I sought that satisfaction from food. Like I was like on a mission to get ease and comfort and satisfaction from food. And I think I came out of the womb that way. And I just experienced life that way, just like always on a quest for more. And so as a result, you know, for someone like me, what it looked like physically, you know, sort of give you like my history, right? Was that at the worst spot of my disease, I was over 300 pounds. And I could not stop, right? You know, and so, you know, it's, it, And there's a solution. There's a part that says opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic or the compulsive overeater, in my case, reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. And so my years of trying to get well, whether it was in Overeaters Anonymous or in a diet program or in therapy, I was always seeking the answer to that riddle, as though if you could tell me why I have this, that would be the magic cure. And the 12 steps don't tell us why. In fact, they say, we don't know why. We can't answer the riddle. And I would say that all the years that I pursued wanting to uncover why, it was something my parents did. It was always going to be something my parents did. You know, that was like my favorite. I would say that's there's spiritual, it's an immature question to be knocking at the door wanting to know why. Because, you know, what I really wanted to do was to assign blame to somebody. And then if they could bear the weight of my blame, I didn't have any responsibility to do anything about it. I could walk the rest of my life. I'm going to be 55 in December. And so even if I found out, oh, you know what? It was that they did to me. I'm 55 years old. I still have to take responsibility for it. It's, you know, that rests squarely on my shoulders. And I can tell you that anything that my parents did, very blessed. I came from a house, they really loved me a great deal. And anything that they may have done to me was unintentional, right? But even if you weren't as fortunate and you came from a house that maybe you weren't as loved, and maybe the things that they did were intentional, you still have the same set of directions as I do. And none of it is on assigning blame to anybody. And I think that's good news, right? Because then we don't have to get in a time machine and undo our past, right? We can actually take action starting right now, you know? So what I grew up hearing a lot of was froth the emotional appeal. And it talks about this in the doctor's opinion. It says, froth the emotional appeal seldom suffices. So people appealing to me from emotion, from saying things like, Melissa, you're a beautiful girl, you're a smart girl, you ought to be able to do it, we'll help you. Or even the other froth the emotional appeal was like, get it together. Get yourself together. What is wrong with you? Pick yourself up and get yourself together. And sometimes that was said to me by people who loved me. By the way, sometimes it was said to people who didn't necessarily love me, who were just kind of cruel, right? Sometimes it was said to me from doctors, right? They would try to scare me into doing something about it. But oftentimes the most frothy emotional appeal came from me to me. I would look at myself in the mirror, or I would try to squeeze into the pants that fit me, I don't know, 2 days before that now I couldn't wear, because when I'm eating, I don't do it. I don't do it in moderation. I don't binge in moderation. So when I've gained weight, I mean, it would be in a day, 2 days, nothing would fit me. And I would appeal to myself from that frothy emotional, like, get it together. What's wrong with you? You know, it never worked, right? It never worked. I loved schemes and quick fixes. That was like my go-to. I was just as addicted to food, I would say, as to the diet, to the thing that was going to cure me. And here's the, you know, I've been a really good dieter at times. I have lost, you know, over 100 pounds. I've done it a couple of times. I thought that was like, I thought I was an anomaly. And then I come to meet so many people on this program who've done that many, many, many times. So it's not even the most like significant, you know, aspect of this problem. But I was addicted to schemes and like quick fixes and anything and all kinds of diets. And I've done every single one, right? And the good news is that we are the type with whom ordinary methods don't work, right? So if you have done all those ordinary methods and some of those extreme methods and they haven't worked for you, you're probably in the right spot, right? This is good news. You may have found your way to the real solution. But I was addicted to schemes and all sorts of things. And what I found out is that every one of those works. Every single one works, mostly, until the day they don't work. And then they don't work again. You know, every diet, if you limit your caloric intake and you move your body more, you will lose weight. If weight was my problem, then diets would be my solution. Same thing with food. If food were my problem, then entire abstinence would be my solution. But when I'm in a state of entire abstinence without the solution, which, you know, I will get to, but before I can get to the solution, you have to know that you need this solution, right? Otherwise, it means nothing. But my greater problem is that when I'm abstinent and seemingly to be doing really well, living like I got this now, I'm doing great, I'm losing weight, I've never felt better, I'm sleeping better, my relation, you know, I would think I would be feeling better, but I wasn't, because it was like every raw nerve was active and alive inside my head. And you know, I would come in a room and the temperature of the room would be displeasing to me, and what this person said to that person over there pissed me off. And you know, and I mean, everything, the way you looked at me was aggravating me. I was like internally itchy, and the one thing that always seemed to be like, you know, that thing that would drive all that out would be the food. I would take a bite and in a second I would go, oh. But remember, I have a spot that can't be hit. So the second I go, ah, now I've triggered a craving. And cravings for compulsive overeaters, people like me, it's different from normal people. When my husband says, or my friends say, I am craving a piece of cake, or I'm craving whatever it is. Once they eat it, their craving is satisfied and they go, ah. But I have the exact opposite experience. Once I eat it, I want more, and I want more than there actually exists. I mean, that's what it is. There is not enough in the world to fill what it is that I want, that I'm hungering for. As soon as I eat it, it's like, you know, I almost think I've had these experiences where I would be at an event and I wouldn't eat there because I knew I could never eat enough there. And I knew somehow in my head, don't even bother trying. There's not enough. You know, when they would cut small slivers of a piece of cake, yeah, no, thank you. Because I don't want the sliver. I want the whole cake. And I want you all to go away. Right? I mean, that's really it. You know, normal people, for them, eating is social. Right? They eat socially. And for me, eating is antisocial. As soon as I begin to eat those foods, I don't want anyone around me. You know, I want to be all alone. And that was the way that I experienced my life, you know, back and forth, always trying to manage and control this thing that I could not manage and control. And I tried diet after diet after diet. I came into Overeaters Anonymous. I had graduated from college. I was 280 pounds, and my life was a mess. All my friends were having success in my eyes. They were pairing up, they were getting married, they were moving in with boyfriends or girlfriends and people were hooking up and going on with their lives and getting good jobs. And I couldn't get it together. I just, you know, I had a degree and I just couldn't, and I was working way beneath my ability. And I was hanging out with people who allowed me to eat and drink the way that I wanted to eat and drink. And so lots of some, I've had some really great friendships, but I spent my time mostly with people who, at a certain point in my life, who allowed me to just be a dead end. You know, they were, it wasn't going anywhere. And I was really unhappy. You know, I was truly unhappy, and I wound up going to Overeaters Anonymous really by mistake. I thought it was another diet. Someone invited me along with them. My friend's parents said that they were going to this diet thing that they heard about, and you want to come? And I was like, yeah, what the heck? You know, they knew I was always on a diet, and I went with them. And they left. They thought this was crazy. They could not relate to any of it. In fact, they were like, that's cuckoo, you know? And I sat there and I heard people say my truth, right? And I was like, oh. When I found out at that meeting, and I was young, I was in my early 20s, I found out about the allergy of the body. And I thought if I could just stay away from those other foods completely, I'll be okay. And, you know, and what happened for me was I worshiped abstinence. Abstinence was, well, actually, yeah, abstinence was God. And I had a food plan, and my food plan was my religion. I practiced the food plan so that I could worship this abstinence of God. And what happened to me was that I lost the weight and I felt great. I got all, by the way, I got all the things that I wanted. Which is why I came to OA at that point in my life. I wanted to meet a guy. I wanted to meet a man. You know, that was my truth. I wanted to meet a man. I wanted to get married. I wanted to have babies. I wanted to get a better job. I wanted to be a grown-up. I wanted to get out of my parents' house and finally be like a grown-up person. And I got all that. And what happened to me was, it explains it perfectly in the chapter More About Alcoholism on page 32. It says, like the man of 30, right? It talks about this man of 30. And he stayed dry for 25 years. For me, it was probably almost 5 years, which is unbelievable to think. But I fell victim, which practically every alcoholic has, that this long period of sobriety, in my case, abstinence, and self-discipline, a great food plan, had qualified me to drink like other men. And so I went on this honeymoon and I looked around and I saw other young women who looked like me. I looked normal at that time. I was a normal weight. I was in a bathing suit with my husband in a beautiful Jamaica. And at the swim up bar, I saw all these young couples drinking these beautiful looking drinks with things in them. It looked so pretty. And I thought, of course I can do this. Why couldn't I do this? But it was ice cream in a glass. I mean, that's really what it was. It was ice cream in a glass. And I can tell you that what happened to me was that rest of that honeymoon, I ate and I drank. I mean, in a way that it was like I let it all loose. But we were having fun. I didn't know I was powerless then. I was certain that I was definitely overindulging. I was like, I am definitely overindulging. But I'll get right back on Monday. I'm going to come home for my honeymoon and no problem. So you don't really find out that you're powerless until, you know, the book says at a certain point that you want to stop. And find you cannot, you might be an alcoholic, right? Which only a spiritual experience, by the way, which I did not have. I must have tuned that out entirely. I had no idea that it was going to be a spiritual experience. I really wanted a diet experience. And so when I came home from my honeymoon, I could not, for the life of me, get back on that plan. that God of abstinence was nowhere to be found, and the religion of my food plan failed me utterly. I couldn't do it. And what happened for me was, like, week after week, I would go to the grocery store and I would buy all my abstinent food, and they would rot in the refrigerator. My car would just be like a magnet right to the drive-through. And within a very short amount of time, I gained everything back, you know, in my early marriage, like that. And it's humiliating. I mean, you know, here's something that's true for the true compulsive overeater. Pain doesn't work. Humiliation doesn't work. Because those things require a mental defense. It requires my memory. And my memory fails to keep me in check. So I've got a great memory. I can, well, not so great anymore. I forget a lot of things now, but pretty much I remember certain things really well. I can't remember with enough force the pain and suffering. Even right now, someone said to me, someone I know who's struggling said to me, I just gotta keep it. Like, I gotta keep that fear alive. And I said, no, actually, by the way, if you're hoping that fear is going to keep you from repeating whatever it is you've done, fear a lot is a reliant on a mental defense. It means I have to remember something that I'm afraid of. And I can't, you know, because in those moments, I think this isn't a big deal. I'm making something a big deal that's not. This is nothing to be afraid of. Or here's what the worst part is that I would reach a certain point where I knew I wasn't going to be able to get away with one. I knew it. At the end of my binging, my end of my eating career, I was not under the delusion that I was going to be able to manage and control this. What I was under the delusion was that I wanted to, like, I didn't care anymore. That's what I actually, my disease would have me believe that I was making a decision to eat as much as I wanted, as if, you know, so it would say to me, you don't care. You don't even care. It doesn't matter. And that is one of the hardest, I would say, you know, I always think, how are we going to help the people who are in that spot? Because how do you help somebody who says, I don't even care anymore. I don't want help. And I would say, you keep hanging out with them. You keep inviting them to your meetings. You keep reaching out to them. Don't roll your eyes at those people. Oh my God, there she goes again. I was that person for years and years. Everybody, by the way, everybody calls themselves a chronic relapser. We're not chronic relapsers. It's the fatal progression of this disease. It's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful. Everybody I know in this program has been a chronic relapser. You know, and so I would hate showing up at the meetings, because I also wanted for a long time, I wanted the OA light plan. I wanted a plan where I could kind of do what I want, you know, and get what I want. You know, I have a friend who says, I wanted to be abstinent without really having to be abstinent. You know, I wanted to be abstinent-ish. I didn't really want to do the whole deal. And I didn't want to have to rely on a power greater than myself, for sure. And I think, you know, what happened for me was I reached a point where I came back to Overeaters Anonymous again. And I came back a number of times, relapsed, came back, relapsed, came back. And the last time I came back, what happened for me was something miraculous. The food stopped working. I couldn't even get the, for a second, I couldn't get it. It was like I was in eating it. I told people my mouth bled. My last binge, my mouth bled. It hurt. It didn't taste good. It didn't feel good. It was nauseating, and I couldn't stop. And I was like, I am in some serious trouble. And at that point, I began to actually take direction. That's when I was like, all right, you know what? I don't care. And when somebody said to me that's going to have to be a, you know, a spiritual solution, you know, I was willing to form my own conception. And I think, you know, step two, when it says form your own conception, you know, my understanding was, you told me my mind was broken. Now you want me to make up God with this broken mind? And so I had like a smart ass attitude. I was going to kind of talk my way out of doing that which needed to be done, which was to start wherever you're at. And you know, what I heard was, for me, it was an incredible thing. I heard the, what sounded like the voice of my father in my head saying, you know, don't be so smart. You want to get well or not? And that was really it. And now what I see is like, when it says form your own conception, conception means your own start. Form your own starting place. I actually don't believe that the book meant that you could make up God. Because if I can make it up, then I might just think I'm it. I can't make up God, right? Only, you know, but I can start wherever I'm at. And in We Agnostics, it says something that I think is really powerful. It says that you can start by asking yourself, what do each of these spiritual concepts mean, spiritual terms mean to you? So I would say, you know what, start looking at some of the spiritual terms and ask yourself, what do they mean to you? And that could be your starting spot. And that's really what it was for me. I landed on a concept of God that I said, you know what, I can start there. And that concept was infinite power and love, which is in the book, and it's capitalized. So it tells me that it's another name for God. And that is what I needed. And that's what I still need. I need something that's infinitely powerful, that is so much more powerful than a food plan, that is so much more powerful than fear, than humiliation, than pain, right? I need it not only to be infinitely powerful, but I need it to be something that cares about me. I have to feel that there is a God personal to me in order to start. And really, so what I decided at that point was, I'll surrender to that. I'll surrender to that which I believe is infinitely powerful and infinitely loving. And if I wasn't sure what it meant, and that's really step three, to turn my will and my life over. What if I don't know what God's will is for me? Well, you're right, I didn't. But I knew what it wasn't. And I could start there, right? I knew that it wasn't to be mean, it wasn't to be dishonest, it wasn't to lie, it wasn't to cheat, it wasn't to steal, it wasn't to gossip, it wasn't to slander, and it certainly wasn't to kill myself with a knife and a fork. So I could start there and I could start pursuing. And whenever I'm in doubt, and this is, holds true today, whenever I'm in doubt, I say to myself, what's the most loving thing I can do in this situation? What is the kindest thing I can do? And I can assume that that's probably aligned with God's will. And if it's not, I can assume that it's a mistake that God will help me correct, because my heart at least is in the right spot. And I didn't have to make it so difficult. And then I took step four and five, you know, which is you put it all down, everything. Write it all down, you know, and there was a voice inside me, you know, like all of us, I came here with a lot of hurt and a lot of anger and a lot of resentment and a lot of justifiable, got it, a lot of justifiable reasons why. And I would say things to myself like, I'm entitled to be mad at them, or I'm entitled to be afraid. And what I found out and giving my fifth step was, I'm actually entitled to better than that. That the God of my understanding wants me to have even more than that, even better than that. And what happened to me is, I worked this program, and I now I've got like a minute a minute left, is that I have had a deep and effective spiritual experience where God has entered my heart and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. And when God lives in your heart, the most incredible thing happens. The strange insanity of returning to the thing that never hits the spot anyway seems like a ridiculous idea. And helping other people seems like the best thing I can possibly do. And I didn't get to share my pictures this time, but that's okay. With that, I'll pass.
Thanks so much, Melissa, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope.